So we thought, as a starter, one of the most useful things we could do is just set out actually what all of the different terminologies are when that people use when referring to Europe. Especially, we've got a number of people receiving a recording of this later on today from the States. And one of the questions that keeps coming up from people when we're talking to them about Brexit is actually, you know, what is the EU, what's the EEA, what's the EC? So that's how we're going to start. And hopefully that will set a useful background for you to go further into the discussion. So where is the European Union? Well, it's Europe, largely. And so on the map, you've got shaded in green all of the countries that are current members of the EU. The European Union is looking to expand out, and along the right-hand side of the slide, there's a list of countries which are seeking to join the EU as well. So the last two in the square brackets are countries which are sort of on the wait list to become candidate countries rather than actually being candidate countries at the moment. But the EU is not just Europe. It actually expands over about one-third of the world when you actually look at it. And this is because France, Portugal, and Spain have all got small countries dotted around the globe, which they see as, so Canary Islands is part of the EU. So we go right over to the Caribbean, we've got some countries in Latin America, and then further over just outside of Madagascar. All of those countries are part of the EU. They have exactly the same rights as all of the other EU countries. They're treated as if they are within the European landmass. We also then have overseas territories. Britain's pretty much a champion of having complicated relationships with overseas countries. We have the Commonwealth, we have overseas territories. Commonwealth leaving aside, the Commonwealth is not part of the EU at all. Completely unrelated. Overseas territories, on the other hand, and there's quite a chunky list of them for Britain, but also France, Netherlands, and Denmark also have a pretty decent list of overseas territories. 25 in total between us all. They are not technically part of the EU, but it's recognised in the treaties that we have a special relationship with those territories. And pretty much every single one has a different special relationship. So it's difficult to give, a broad overview of what they say. But broadly, they don't have EU law, so they're not bound by the law. But people in those countries are typically EU citizens. So they have the right of freedom of movement within the EU. But we in Britain and in the European landmass part of the EU don't have the right of freedom of movement to those countries. So if, for example, you want to move to the Cayman Islands, just because you're in the EU and the Cayman Islands is an overseas territory doesn't mean you can just go there. You still have to go through the usual visa rights. But if somebody from the Cayman Islands, why, would want to move to the UK, they can just do that because they have the rights as one-way freedom of movement. Freedom of movement goes within four areas, and these are the sort of the fundamental things that make the EU the EU. So there's freedom of movement of goods, capital, people, and establishment and of services. And pretty much wherever you are in the EU, you can do any of those things in any of the EU countries. So that's the EU in a nutshell. Next, we move on to the EEA, or the European Economic Area. And there's been a lot of chat amongst this Brexit talk about Norway and Iceland and the deal that they have. And essentially, Iceland, Norway, and Liechtenstein have a special agreement with the EU, which is the European Economic Area. And essentially, it's a sort of EU light. So they are bound by the rules of the EU. They're bound by the four freedoms. But they have special carve-outs, and the carve-outs are for farms, fish, tax, justice, and foreign policy. So especially, for example, Iceland, it's a massive fishing area, so having control over their fishing rules, a really important thing for them. So they have that carve-out. They still pay the same amount as all of the EU members for membership of the European club, but they don't have representatives in the European Parliament, so they don't actually get to influence European Union policies and laws. They just get to abide by them, except for those ones that are in their carve-out. Next, we have Switzerland. So you can think of Switzerland as the EU's sort of best non-EEA friend. So Switzerland is probably the country that we have, or that the EU has the closest relationship with outside of Iceland, Norway, and Liechtenstein. And basically, Switzerland had a referendum to decide whether they were going to join the EU, decided no, and so they've had to come up with their own version of European Union or the EEA. And they have broadly three ways of doing this. So firstly, they're in Schengen, and we'll discuss this in a moment. They're also part of an alliance with Norway, Liechtenstein, and Iceland. And then they have over 100 bilateral agreements with the EU, which doesn't quite get them into the same position as the countries in the European Economic Area, but in many areas gets them pretty close. The Schengen area, and this is something that Switzerland had to sign up to in order to get access to the other bilateral treaties that they have with the EU. And essentially, it is a border-free zone in the European landmass. So on the map in front of you, you've got a list of all of the countries that are part of Schengen, and all of the countries shaded in blue have this border-free borders, if that makes sense. So essentially, you can walk from one end of Europe to the other end without having to show a passport, without having to say whether you're there for business or pleasure. Notably, the UK is outside of Schengen, and Ireland is also outside of it. So with Switzerland, people can move in and out of Switzerland as much as they want, but they can't necessarily stay in Switzerland and make it their home. So we've gone through three of the European permutations. Now we have the Eurozone. This is nothing to do with football. As a Welsh person, I felt I needed to just bring the Euros into this in any kind of contrived way that I possibly could. So this is nothing to do with the Euro football competition at all. And it's also to do with money. So the Eurozone is something which sits technically within the EU. It's the European Union currency. And 19 out of the 28 European Union states have opted into using the euro currency. Seven of the states are not quite in, so they've said they'd like to be in there, but they're working to meet certain financial conditions that you have to meet in order to be able to get into the euro. And we've all seen from Greece that it's really important that you actually meet those financial conditions and you don't possibly massage them so you say you've met them. So there's seven countries that are working towards being within the Eurozone. Two of the EU states are out and will always, or as much as we know, will always be out, and that's the UK and Denmark. But as with everything to do with Europe, there are some little footnotes here. There are some non-European Union states that have a special relationship with the Eurozone. So San Marino, Monaco, Andorra, and Vatican City all have the ability to print euros within those countries or city-states and use the euro as their currency. So these are not part of the European Union, but use the European Union currency. They're also sort of nominal members of Schengen, so you can move within them without your passport. The next permutation that Europe has developed is the EU Customs Union. And the Customs Union allows for free movement of goods within the Customs Union without having customs charges, and it creates a uniform border around the Union. So anything that is imported, whether it's imported to Ireland or Turkey, which is in the Union, there will be the same customs charge to bring it into the Union. Once it's in, it can move within the Union customs free. The EU Customs Union includes all EU member states and then some additional extras. Probably the most notable extras, Turkey is an interesting one, especially given everything that may or may not be going on there at the moment. And the Channel Islands is an interesting one for many of our clients as well. We're nearly there. European Free Trade Association. It's interesting that probably most people have never had to really think about what any of these things are, except if they were in law school. And now, of course, you pick up pretty much any paper, and you know these terms are just thrown around with abandon. The European Free Trade Association, EFTA, is an alliance of Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Switzerland, and it promotes free trade within those countries and economic integration. EFTA has an agreement with the EU, which creates the EEA, which, except for Switzerland, which creates the single market. So we've got the EEA, and if we flick back, so the EEA links into the European Union. And the way the EEA is created is by these countries in EFTA having an agreement with the EU. So they essentially create a single market. Now the asterisk here is Switzerland. So Switzerland is part of EFTA, but they're not part of the agreement that creates the EEA because Switzerland have all of these bilateral agreements. Last one, EEC and EC. So a number of people have said, how does the European community, how does the European economic community fit into all of this? Essentially, Europe, the European Union has been a developing beast, and it started out as a series of agreements dealing with specific areas. So we had the European Economic Community, which dealt with economics. We had the coal and steel community and the atomic energy community. And these three communities together created the European community or the European communities or the common market. These in the Maastricht Treaty of 1993 were consolidated into the European Union. And the European Union is formed of three pillars. The European communities form one pillar, foreign policy and the controversial idea of the European army for another pillar, and then the final pillar is to do with justice and home affairs and extradition rights and how we deal with those issues. So the three pillars together make up the European Union. So the European community still exists, but it has been subsumed within the European Union. And this is it all on, or this is largely all of it on one slide. I kind of think with life, anything that you can put into a Venn diagram is probably better. And so this is my attempt at a Venn diagram. If you're printing the slides, it's probably better if you print them in color, because I think that helps make the differentiation. But it shows actually what a, I don't know, finely crafted or absolute mess that Europe is. And it kind of gives an indication that when people are talking about Britain leaving the EU, why there are so many different ways that it could do that. I mean, really, we could fall into any of these circles.
Except one.
Oh, yeah, except one. Well, I mean, that also kind of depends. But if we leave the EU, we could go into any of them. I mean, we could adopt the euro and leave the EU. We could follow Vatican City. So that's it in one slide. And I really wanted to avoid talking about the European Union institutions this morning, because in many ways they are more complex than the various different European relationships that countries have. So I very much simplified it. And I've done it again on one slide, because if you can put things onto one page of paper, then it just makes everything more manageable. So this is broadly how some of the key EU institutions work. Essentially, you have the European Parliament, and that is consisting of European members of Parliament who are voted for by citizens of each European country. You have the Council of the EU, which is made up of ministers from each of the national governments. And then you have the European Commission, which is appointed by the Council of the EU and which is supervised by the European Parliament. And just as a little footnote here, it's worth noting that the Council of the EU and the European Council are different things. And I tried to get that into the Venn diagram, but I ran out of space without going on to A3, which, essentially, just as a note, the European Council is a body that deals with human rights and is made up of over 40 countries. All of the EU members are part of it, and then obviously other European countries as well. It doesn't impact any of this, so it's not actually written down anywhere. just a note. And the way legislation works in the EU, the Commission proposed legislation, it is then considered jointly by the European Parliament and the Council, and then the European Parliament and the Council jointly adopt legislation and we come out with European decisions or European legislation. And then the Commission monitors that each member state is adhering to its obligations under the legislation. So anyone who's followed any of the state aid cases recently, if you're wondering why it's the European Commission bringing those claims against states for, they say, going against European law, it's because it's the Commission's role to monitor European law. And then the Court of Justice of the EU is the body which makes decisions about whether European countries are adhering to law or not. So the European Commission could send things to the Court of Justice, or alternatively, member states could send decisions or send issues to the courts themselves. And this is why I didn't want to talk about the EU institutions, because once you get into it, you're basically going down a rabbit hole of which there probably is no end. So that, in about 14 minutes, was an overview of Europe. So how does the UK exit the EU? Suddenly, every single person in Britain is an expert on EU treaties, and Article 50 is bandied about just like people would chat about football. They might do anyway. Article 50 is an article within the treaties which enables countries to exit the EU. You have to feel that probably a lot of thought wasn't given to the drafting of it when it was put in, and people sort of thought, we'll deal with this when we come to it. And probably everyone here has done that at some point in drafting or looking at some agreement that they have done in their career. And basically, to exit, there has to be a formal notification given by the exiting state to the Council. And if you remember, the Council is made up of ministers from each government. They give a formal notification. No one knows how that notification is given. So it could just be, you know, they stand up and they say it in one of their meetings, we're going to trigger Article 50, we want to exit. Or it can be written. It's however the country decides. And then negotiations start. Everyone knows that there's a two-year period in which to negotiate. This two-year period can be extended, but only by unanimous consent. And at the end of that two-year period, things are where they fall, which puts the UK in a difficult negotiating position, because the EU could just say, oh, we're busy. Oh, 2 years has run up. You don't get anything. Everyone has to hope that that's not where we end up, because we have been in a long-term relationship with these people. Hopefully it hasn't ended acrimoniously. We still have to, you know, for the children, we still have to deal with each other. We're still big trading partners. It is in everyone's interest to come to a good arrangement at the end of it. When negotiating our exit, so there's going to be a treaty, we expect that there will be a treaty setting out our exit terms. And in negotiating our exit, one of the things that needs to be taken into account is our future relationship with the EU. So we're actually going to be negotiating two things in parallel, and it's almost a chicken and an egg. We need to know what our future relationship is going to look like in order to establish what our exit will look like. But obviously, we kind of need to know what our exit is going to look like to work out what our future relationship is going to look like. So it's you know, interesting. What are our constitutional requirements? I couldn't decide whether to leave this slide blank or just fill it with white noise. And I opted for white noise because actually there's just so much being said about this, but actually no one really knows. We don't know how we trigger Article 50. You will all have seen that there's been a petition for a second referendum. Had over 4 million people sign that. They think that that's a compelling reason to have a second referendum. That's actually going to be debated in Parliament on the 5th of September, although all of the indications are that there will not be a second referendum. But there are at least 7 private legal challenges going through the High Court at the moment as to how the referendum was run, but also what happens next? So the big debate really is, can the PM exercise royal prerogative and just go to her next council meeting and say, oh, by the way, we're doing Article 50? Or does there need to be full parliamentary approval? Does there need to be a debate in Parliament? Does there need to be an act of Parliament? And so one of these claims in particular has now been given a date to be heard in the High Court in October. So as part of the initial hearing of that, it's been confirmed by the government that they will not be doing anything to do with Brexit before the end of this year. And so we should at least have the High Court decision before anything actually happens. Obviously, things can get appealed, and things are reasonably slow moving their way at the courts. And so if there's a decision of the High Court and the losing party decides to challenge it, it's interesting to see, or it will be interesting to see, whether the exercise of Article 50 has to be postponed pending, you know, the final decision of the UK. I haven't really thought through this through, but it would be really interesting if somebody sent the decision over how we exercise Article 50 to the European Court of Justice. I don't know if that could ever happen, if you could ever frame it in such a way that it could get up there, but that could be an interesting result. So as I say, we need to be agreeing two things in parallel, our withdrawal and also our trading relationship, but actually, you know, practically, what do we need to agree? So at the moment, we pay everyone's year the 350 million weekly contribution, you know, whatever we contribute, we need to decide, are we still contributing? So if we go for the Norway approach, which a lot of people have said, we'll still be contributing. Norway contributes per capita the same amount as other European Union members. So will we still be contributing cash to the EU? Will we still get cash from the EU? As a Welsh person, actually, getting cash from the EU is a really important thing. What happens to people who are living in the UK who are from Europe? What happens to people who are living in Europe who are from the UK? Can they stay? Do they have accrued rights? Are we going to respect those rights? There's been a little bit of talk from the government about what about people who are coming to the UK or leaving the UK post-Brexit referendum, but pre-Brexit? Are they going to be treated differently to people who were just here and, you know, always have been here? We also have a ton of people in Europe. We have all of our European Parliament members, but we also have a load of civil servants over there. Are we going to bring those all back to the UK? Are we going to leave some of them out there? When are they going to exit? So we already know that the UK has decided to withdraw from it. So the Council of Ministers, every 6 months, they change who is the president. The UK is due to be president. We've already said we're not going to hold our presidency. Actually, what's the position of our civil servants over there at the moment? Do they have as much of a say as anyone else? Because at the moment, we're still full members. We're still paying our full amount into it. We're still bound by all of the laws. What about the European Court? Actually, if things are going through the courts at the moment, you know, do we pause those things while we wait? Do we have to, if the European Court has said some of our laws are wrong, do we change them and then change them back in 2 years' time? How does that work? And then border controls. At the moment, it's pretty easy to get, well, it's reasonably easy to get over into Europe, and then once you're there, we can move around really easy. What's going to happen there? That is particularly important, I think, in the Irish context, so north to south. So those are some of the key things that need to be agreed. Next, what would Brexit look like? Again, you know, we can crystal ball gaze about what it might look like, but it might look something else. As I said earlier, the UK is a champion at complicated relationships with overseas countries, and who knows, we might just create something brand new that we can add to the Venn diagram. But an attempt to say what it could be. Brexit means Brexit, is what people have been saying, but who knows what Brexit is. It's a brand new word. I don't think it's in the dictionary yet, so we don't really know what it means. We don't know when it's going to happen. It's definitely not going to happen this year, so the earliest that we could actually leave the EU is the 1st of January 2019, which is, you know, a reasonably long time. David Davis, the Brexit minister, has said before or by the start of next year, which doesn't really mean anything. The courts have been told not this year. And May has interestingly said that she wants to get Scotland on board before she starts the process. Now, everyone knows that Scotland definitely do not want to come out of Europe. So maybe this is a really cunning ploy to just delay the whole thing until everyone forgets about it. And actually, we're never going to get Scotland on board. So, and you know, every year they say, oh, yeah, we're just waiting for Scotland. And Scotland say, yeah, we still like Europe. So who knows? Post-Brexit, what about our EU treaties? Are we just automatically not bound by those anymore? What about where we've implemented law in the UK to implement EU treaties? What happens in that? It's UK law, but it's implemented in the EU. I know I was speaking to somebody from HMRC the other day, and they were saying that they are really concerned that they're all pretty much going to have to look at every single, you know how much tax law there is. They're going to have to look at every single tax law and decide how it was influenced by EU. I mean, we've got a two-year period in which to do this. There's only a limited number of people in HMRC, and you can't see them giving up on things like actual tax collecting to do that process. So it's an interesting one.
It's a sort of very, very basic matter. To the extent that UK law is influenced by either treaties or directives which require domestic legislation to implement the effect of a treaty or a directive, then you have to look at UK law and decide what to change, because that's already in force. To the extent that we're affected by EU regulations which have direct effect, those will naturally fall away. So, and there's a distinction there between VAT on the one hand, which is implemented through local law via, adopting a directive, and customs union, which is implemented through regulation.
So, this is our take on the possible models that we could have. Norway. Everyone talks about Norway. We've seen Norway is part of the EEA, so they essentially have the European Union light, but with the full cost of it. So they're fully bound by the single market rules, including free movement, and that includes free movement of people, which seemed to be one of the things that the Brexiteers were really against. So it would be interesting if we get the Norway model, because people who wanted to stay in the EU will be unhappy because we've lost all of our influence. And people who wanted to leave the EU will probably also be unhappy because the NHS definitely isn't getting 350 million a week because it's still going to Europe. And we still have free movement of people. So Norway seems like the result that we may end up with, but is the result that no one's going to be happy with.
It's really kind of the worst of, from a US perspective, it's kind of the worst of both worlds, right? You have everything that you don't want to have, and you've lost whatever, maybe it's a small voice, but whatever voice there is, that voice is now gone.
Yeah.
So it just seems like a kind of, if that's the result, it seems all kind of silly, right?
It also means that loads of politicians and civil servants are out of a job. And we would not be part of the VAT area or the VAT area if we did that, unless we negotiated a special VAT add-on. We could be like Switzerland, which also seems like a bad result. So we could possibly join the little EFTA. So we could join Iceland, Norway, Liechtenstein, and Switzerland, and have a little kind of free trade agreement with them, and then arrange bilateral agreements with the EU. So, to negotiate over 100 bilateral agreements with the EU seems an unlikely result in 2 years. Whether we could just look at Switzerland's and copy Switzerland's, I don't know. Again, that is an option. Having a lot of bilateral agreements seems like a fairly clunky way of doing it, but it is an option. We could be like Turkey, which seems massively unappealing right now. And that would essentially mean we'd join the customs union, so we'd be able to trade within the EU without customs. We wouldn't be part of the EU VAT area. Joining the customs union seems like a reasonably attractive option, but obviously would make it more difficult for us negotiating bilateral agreements with other trading partners, because we would be bound by the customs union rule on imports and customs in that respect. So kind of a good and a bad result there. And that completely ignores all the stuff to do with free movement and all of that kind of stuff. We could be like South Korea or Canada or somewhere like that. And essentially that we could agree a free trade agreement with the EU, and we could get a special agreement with the EU. I think David Davis has talked about this all taking a process of 6 years, and that kind of fits in with this South Korea / Canada idea. I think Canada were negotiating with the EU for around 6 years before coming up with the first draft of their trading agreement with the EU. You would hope we would be quicker because we already understand how the EU works, we already have the relationship, but that might be something that we're looking at. But that doesn't cover any of the free movement of people. It doesn't tell us what we do about any of the European law that has been binding us for the last number of decades. And then finally, we go like the US, and we have just the standard WTO rules. We're not part of any special relationship with the EU. We just agree kind of agreements either with the EU or with just individual countries. We're not part of a customs union. We're not part of a VAT area. And we're just completely standalone. That feels like an unlikely result, just because Europe and the UK are we're so close physically, but we are such big trading partners. That seems like a really impractical result to reach. But who knows, right? No one really knows what's going to happen.
And again, kind of just so the only true single market option listed on this page is the first one. That's the Norway option.
That's right.
And then the Switzerland option is sort of single market light. Is that kind of the way to think about it?
That's right.
Okay.
But obviously, so just kind of going back to that, if we go with the EEA, it's still we're still full paying members. If we go with Switzerland, one of the things that Switzerland had to do to get access to all of these bilateral treaties is sign up to Schengen, so this border free movement area. The UK is really against that. The UK and Ireland have historically said, we're an island, we're different. And actually that might be something which we'd have to give up to be like Switzerland.
Maybe focusing on tax a little bit, really, I think to get a sense of the impact potentially of Brexit of taxes, the first question is really how does the EU impact taxes in each of the member states? And for that, there's really a difference between indirect taxes and direct taxes. For indirect taxes, what we mean is VAT, excise tax, custom duties, all those type of taxes that really affect the movement of goods and potentially services. One of the cornerstones of the EU, as Karin Wendt said, is the free movement of goods, services, capital, and people. And so from very early stage, the goal of the EU has been to harmonize the legislation relating to those type of taxes, to ensure there's a freedom of those goods within the single market, and there is no unfair competition between the EU member states when it comes to those type of taxes. So indirect taxes generally are dealt at the EU level, usually by way of directive or research style regulations in the case of custom duties, and it's not an area that is left to the member states. And the EU would set a general framework specifying taxes, the rates, specify the type of exemption. Although the EU does not set the rate and does not raise taxes, it really ensures that the system is harmonized among all of the member states. And obviously the European Court of Justice is there to ensure that the application of those EU rules are harmonized within the EU. So to take the example of, to take VAT for example, VAT now is a tax that is completely harmonized at the EU level. And so the, all the intra-EU transactions are governed by the directive of 2006, as well as EU regulation and the decision from the European Court of Justice. And really the goal of VAT at the EU level is to ensure there's no double VAT when goods travel within the EU, and really ensuring that the tax is only paid by the end users. And what the EU VAT system will ensure is to make sure that the place where the chargeable event is a specific event, and all the EU members will agree that the same rules apply. And there's going to be a difference between any transaction within the EU are considered intra-EU supplies, and when the EU member states will deal with third parties, always be treated differently, those are considered import or exports. There are actually going to be very little freedom for the EU member states when it comes to VAT. They really need to apply the EU directive, transpose them into their domestic law. And for example, the EU directive will say that on VAT, for example, the rate of tax on goods and services cannot be less than 15%, for example. So relatively little freedom from the EU member state to deviate from the EU directive.
Anyone who followed the tampon tax debate a few months ago will have seen just how little freedom each member state has to change the rates on
specific
supplies.
Products.
Yeah.
And so the question is that, well, how does that might look like post-Brexit? As Richard said, technically the EU directives would fall away once the UK does not is no longer a member state. Keeping in mind that because the VAT was regulated by directives, not by way of regulation, all those directives had to be transposed into UK law. So actually, VAT in the UK is a creature of UK law as well as EU law. So obviously, if the UK is no longer part of the EU, it would no longer have to comply with EU law. It would have more flexibility to set tax rate, to set up exemption for certain goods and services. The flip side, obviously, is that transactions with the EU are no longer intra-EU transaction, and they would become import and exports with what is technically now a third-party country with the possible application of VAT. Obviously, the implication that you could have additional pricing costs resulting from the application of VAT to transaction with the EU. And all the existing structure really would need to be reviewed to see what would be the impact from a VAT perspective. We work a lot with private equity fund, for example. VAT planning is important, taking the example of management fee, and all those structures would need to be reviewed just prior to Brexit to determine what the impact could be. Obviously, a huge compliance burdens for most of our clients who export goods and services to the EU, because there are now a number of invoices, compliance systems that are put in place with in dealing with the EU, all those we need to be reviewed. There's a question would now, for example, VAT representative have to be required in the EU. All those, it's not going to be just taxes, all the compliance aspects might be used as well. And the risk, obviously, is the risk is that UK law, when it comes to VAT, could become really frozen in time, and the question will be, well, what happens if going forward the UK does not apply new EU rules dealing with VAT, does not apply new European decisions from the European Court of Justice, and you could be, even if the UK decides to keep VAT, you could be in a situation where there will be a divergence between really the way the UK is implementing VAT and the way the European Union or the rest of the EU member state actually continue to apply VAT. And obviously, an option, because the UK would no longer be bound by EU law, is that it could choose a completely different system than VAT, and technically what could think of maybe the UK adopting a goods and sales tax or the sales tax that we have in the United States, although that seems really unlikely given the trend now globally towards VAT systems.
that I guess the big, you know, that one of the unknowns around that obviously is to what extent does the negotiation process sort of impact our ability to detach from the VAT system.
That's right.
And so, you know, that is at this point completely unknown, but it could be that we are, you know, in effect remain bound to maintaining a VAT system or not. We don't know.
Custom duty is another area which is likely to evolve following Brexit because, again, freedom of movement of goods is a cornerstone of the single market. It's ensured to make sure the market is efficient, to promote free trade, and really this is an area which is fully harmonized at the EU level. As Richard said, there are a number of EU regulations. And really, the way the system works currently is that there are no custom duties on transfer of goods within the EU market. So a good can be produced in the UK, it can be transferred to France or Germany, and there are absolutely no custom duty along the way. Things are different for imports. So for example, if a third country decides to import a good within the EU, it's usually subject to custom duties when it enters the EU, but when that good then travels within the EU, there's no additional custom duty at that point. So really a single market, and to ensure really the free movement of goods within the EU. The other point that is really interesting when it comes to custom duties is that actually, as Kainwen said, a number of trade agreements have been negotiated, not by EU member state individually, but by the EU as a whole. For example, with Chile or Mexico, and those EU-level free trade agreements actually regulate the trade between the EU and those third parties, the amount of custom duties that will be charged, the tariffs on import of those goods. And the question is going to be, well, what happens following Brexit? Do those treaties continue to apply to the UK? Will the third party be actually happy with that situation? Because we are now no longer talking about a market of 300 million people, but just the EU, UK market, and will they want to keep the same level of tariffs to when they are importing or exporting services to the UK, goods to the UK? And all those questions will have to be faced, and there's a very short amount of time, obviously, between the notification of the Brexit process and Brexit itself. And just as a side note, actually, custom duty represents an important part of the EU budget. It's actually 75% of all the custom duties that are charged when goods are brought into the EU are actually related to the EU. So what happened post-Brexit? Obviously, in theory, much more flexibility for the UK because it could decide its custom duty policy, the rates. The risk, of course, is that all the trade with the EU member state would become import and exports, with potentially the application of custom duties on transfer of goods from, to take again my example, between the UK and France. There could be, in theory, custom duties that could apply. And obviously, that's going to be a question that's going to be intertwined between the question of access to the single market. It's probably going to be one of those key negotiation points, obviously, as the UK gets to negotiate its exit with the EU. And obviously, that's not just going to impact the relationship between the UK and the EU. That's also going to impact the relationship between the UK and all the third party states, and how the question is whether all those free trade agreements that have been negotiated at the EU level will survive following Brexit. And what the alternative, obviously, as we saw earlier, there are other type of relationships that have been built with other countries. Right now, we have the EEA model, where there's actually no custom duties, but obviously the EEA member countries have had to accept the free movement of goods, capital, services, and more importantly of persons, which might be politically difficult for the UK to follow as a model. And another model potentially is the Turkey model, which is also followed with Andorra and Monaco, which is itself only a custom union. So new custom duties, obviously, but as we said earlier, other disadvantages compared to the existing system. Leaving the area of indirect taxes, the EU also has obviously an enormous impact on direct taxes. And by those, I mean really corporate and income taxes. That's an area that is not determined at the EU level. It's an area of that belongs to national competencies, so it means that direct taxes are the sole responsibility of the member states. But that's really not the end of the story, because each member state has to agree and abide by all the EU principles, which mean freedom of goods, freedom of movement, freedom of person, freedom of capital. So the legislation of each member state dealing with direct taxes has to comply with those principles, which means as a practical matter that the member states are not completely free. And there are also a number of areas where the EU has decided to regulate and to pass directives, for example, to ensure to minimize tax avoidance, to build up cooperation, and also to minimize tax leakage on transactions with the EU. And obviously, and the
was that too quick?
Actually, so by way of example. In the area of not just taxes directly, but cooperation, we have the EU Mutual Assistance Directive, which has actually been in place since 77, which is intended to ensure that there's cooperation and exchange of information between tax authorities and the EU. It has been amended recently in December of last year to include exchange of rulings and advanced pricing agreements, and again last week where there was a proposal to give access to tax authorities to anti-money laundering information. So a lot of cooperation already within EU member states, and the question is that what will happen once the UK leaves the EU, will that also fall away, or will there be some kind of special relationship on tax cooperation? And the latest one, obviously, which is EU Anti-Tax Avoidance Directive, which was adopted last week by the EU Council, which is intended to prevent aggressive tax planning, to increase tax transparency, and really the purpose is to try to ensure consistent application of PEPs among the EU, and will actually require the member state to implement in their domestic legislation anti-abuse mechanism like CFC rules, legislation dealing with hybrids, and exit tax, and that's intended to be effective in 2019. And the question is going to be, well, what will happen in the UK if, you know, they trigger the exit process in 2017, if they're out in 2019, how would that all fit in? Will the UK actually, you know, change the legislation to implement that, the directive?
Well, I think it's fair to say, though, that the UK has taken it upon itself to be a leader in the implementation of BEPS. So, you know, directionally, it would be a bit surprising if any of that had an impact on the UK's approach to BEPS. We'd already seen partial implementation and some more stuff coming through in the Finance Act 2016. So, you know, the UK, I would think, is unlikely to change direction, whatever happens on this.
And then there are also a number of directives leaving the area of tax cooperation, but really directives that directly impact taxes and how much tax is paid on cross-border transactions. The main one, you know, that impacts a lot of structures of our client is obviously the parent subsidiary directive, which has two aspects, because it really ensures that there is no withholding tax on payments of dividends between an EU subsidiary and its EU parent, and also it ensures that there is no two level of tax by ensuring that there is no double taxation when the parent company receives a dividend that has already been taxed at the level of the when really the income has already been taxed at the level of the subsidiary. The interest and royalties directive that's also ensured that there is no withholding tax on payment of interest and royalties between EU companies. You know, IPs is very often based in Ireland. The interest and royalties are to help. And obviously, the last one is the EU merger directive, which ensures there is no tax on gains in the case of merger or spin-off or contribution involving EU companies. And the question is...
Yeah, sorry.
And the question is really what happens post-Brexit. Those directives refers to only apply those beneficial treatment to companies in EU member state if the UK is no longer an EU member state, well, the benefit of those directives should just fall away. And potentially what could happen is that you could be in a situation where there is now going forward following Brexit actually either UK withholding tax on payment of dividends, interest and royalties to the EU parent, or the flip side, there could be withholding tax imposed by the EU subsidiary to its UK parent on dividends, interest, and royalties. Obviously, the UK has also entered into a number of double tax treaties, including with every one of the EU member states, and you could, as a fallback, rely on the double tax treaty to see whether you might get an exemption or a reduction in the rate of withholding tax, but those double tax treaty actually don't always give you the same benefits and the same rates as the EU directive being usually much more favorable. And so the question is, well, what will happen post-Brexit? And clients should really be reviewing their structure to see whether there are exposure for tax leakage on payment cross-border between the UK and the EU.
And this is a really big one, I think, because as people know, the UK does not impose withholding tax on dividends under domestic law, and so its position currently, at least, is a little bit, you know, asymmetric. if the parent subsidiary directive falls away, because most double tax treaties, so far as dividends are concerned, within related parties, the withholding tax is generally at 5%, and most other countries do impose withholding tax on dividends. So this is really quite a big area.
Yeah, and to get the benefit of the 5%, it's usually a higher threshold than the directive. It's usually 25%. So, but it's not just structures within. That will need to be reviewed is also all the contracts that will need to be reviewed. Contracts, for example, that provide for gross-up, I'm thinking about all the credit agreements that says, for example, withholding tax is imposed on the payment of interest and the borrower will gross-up, then all of a sudden, if the benefit of the EU directive falls away and there is withholding tax, you could be in a situation where it actually becomes very, very expensive because you will not. You will need to gross up, in effect, the lenders. And the question is, do you have in your agreement, for example, changing law provisions? Do you have MAC clause that would allow you to get out of those provisions? And do you need to start to introduce actually those clause to make sure that in the case of withholding tax becomes imposed because of Brexit, you can get out of those obligation?
And we're already beginning to see, you know, structures being put in place for deals where, for whatever reason, the UK holding company is being included in the structure, but at the same time there is sort of post Brexit planning being thought about as to how to re-domesticate the UK holding company to somewhere else, should the Brexit discussions go the wrong way.
That's right.
then also just, I mean, just to jump in quickly, this whole concept of the benefits that arise by virtue of being a member of the EU, I mean, that also comes up in some other places. So, for example, in some of the tax treaties, including the tax treaty with the United Kingdom that the US has, there's, it's been in the press that all the US tax treaties have these limitation on benefits provisions. And one of the for the more recent US treaties, again, including with the United Kingdom, there is a particular prong of the limitation on benefits provision that provides derivative benefits to a company that's owned, that basically there's an ownership requirement, and it looks to, as qualifying persons, any member of the European Union. And so potentially now you could have a situation where, and Luxembourg is another treaty. So if you have a United Kingdom company that's qualifying under from a US-UK perspective, that owns a Luxembourg company, that Luxembourg company can currently qualify as a good treaty person for you from a US perspective because of the fact that it's owned by a UK company as a member of the EU. If the UK leaves the EU, that benefit would fall away. So there are a bunch of, sort of hidden places where, I think EU membership actually can help you that aren't obvious, and that's just sort of another example.
But obviously also thinking of alternative and what kind of relationship actually the UK might have with the EU, it's interesting to note that, for example, in the case of Switzerland, the bilateral agreements between Switzerland and the EU actually give fairly similar benefits to Switzerland than the EU parent subsidiary directive and the EU interest and royalties directive. So maybe that would be an option.
So we, along with a lot of other people, have sort of started to think about the UK tax system and the effect over the years on it of EU law. And that process for us is just started, but there are a number of examples, particularly in the corporation tax arena, where changes in the last 10, 15 years in particular to the system have been driven largely by the somewhat xenophobic approach that the UK corporation tax rules had. And for example, the group relief rules were very UK-centric in terms of what type of company could benefit from group or consortium relief, how groups were linked together in order to qualify for group relief, and the corporation tax rules over the years have been changed in order to ensure that they don't offend the freedom, particularly the freedom of establishment principle. Similarly, the CFC rules and the recent changes in them have been heavily influenced by there was the Cambridge-Schweppes decision and a subsequent sort of reworking and rethinking of them. The rules on reorganisations, reconstructions, demergers, those have been changed over the years in order either to implement directives or to ensure that they don't offend freedom of establishment. The rules on taxation of dividends between companies and the what is now a generous UK participation exemption for dividends, the starting point to that was a concern that the tax neutrality of dividends between UK companies, but no other, offended EU principles. There have been court decisions in the context of stamp duty reserve tax and the HSBC decision The way in which the incidence of stamp duty reserve tax on the issue of shares offended the capital duty directive. The thin capitalization and transfer pricing rules, and the fact that at one point transfer pricing between UK companies was, or rather the transfer pricing rules did not apply but do apply now. And going right back to the beginning, in the sense of the first real case, the Daily Mail case, and the transfer of tax residence and the need in those days to obtain Section 765 consent to the transfer of residence of a company. All of those are some examples of how UK tax rules, particularly in the corporate arena, have been affected by EU legislation, either by court decision or by fear of challenge. And so the question is, to what extent is there going to be a rethinking of all that? And that, of course, in turn depends on what type of agreement is reached with the EU. As the governments start to think about how to sort of reform their tax policy and how it fits within the EU, there's a whole range, as Kaimla mentioned at the beginning, of issues that will need to be thought about.
Moving on now to state aid and harmful tax practices. What is the status currently? You have the under the EU treaty, the EU treaty forbids member states to use state resources in order to provide aid to businesses that would distort competition or and affect trade between EU member states, and the scope of state aid is very wide, and it of course includes any form of tax incentive or benefit, and particularly, and we've seen that since 2013, tax rulings, because the European Commission has taken the approach that certain specific tax rulings that some multinationals had obtained in EU member states were give them a competitive advantage that could potentially distort competition. So, as you very well know, that there are investigations going on. Also, we have the EU Code of Conduct. That was adopted in 97. I think, 97, and it's not a legally binding instrument, but it has a strong political force, and it requires EU member states to abolish existing harmful tax measures. So this is what was called the rollback, and refrain from introducing new harmful tax measures. So that's what is called the standstill. Following the referendum, the idea was developed that leaving the EU would give certain leeway to the UK to become a sort of European tax haven. So it's probably unlikely that there will be major changes, particularly because, as we've mentioned, the UK is strongly committed to the BEPS project implementation within the OECD. And it's also interesting to note, as we've said earlier, the EEA agreement in some various aspects mimics the EU treaty, and that includes, and so the EEA agreement includes state aid rules that are kind of equivalent to the EU treaty state aid rules. So assuming that the UK stays within the EEA, it probably wouldn't have a lot of leeway to implement measures that could be considered as state aid under the EU treaty currently. So what it can do actually currently.
Obviously, Brexit, as we say, its implication in the UK, what it means for the UK in terms of taxes, but obviously the question is going to be also, what does it mean for the other EU member states that are left behind, if you want? Obviously, it's not just the UK companies that will need to review their structure from a tax perspective. EU companies also will need to go through the same exercise in there to the extent they have existing relationship with UK companies, and to see whether there are actually risk of tax leakage and whether there's actually maybe a need for reorganization, and whether that makes sense to do that prior to Brexit, for example. What I'm thinking is, for example, legislation of EU member state that refer to EU member state to give certain beneficial tax treatment, with certain beneficial tax regime, as soon as the UK is out, well, the word EU member state no longer refers to the UK, and in effect, tax lawyers in each of those EU member states will need to go through their domestic legislation and see whether their own legislation will continue to apply to the UK going forward if the legislation only refers to EU member state, which is probably going to be a fairly painful exercise, but which will be done just in each of the 27 member states that are left behind. Other thing is that obviously going forward, if the UK is out of the EU, cornerstone principle that apply and that benefit UK companies like freedom of establishment would no longer apply to UK companies. So for example, payments received from UK company by EU parent may be subject to additional tax charges. There was a recent case in France regarding Steria and the idea that France should not discriminate EU companies and give them really the same beneficial tax treatment as it gives to the French subsidiaries. Well, technically, those rules going forward will no longer apply to UK companies. The EU member state would be able to discriminate UK companies and not give them the same deal as they give to EU, EU companies. That we say it's fair. That would be the EU view. Other area, for example, to give you another example, is the area of tax consolidation. There was a recent case from the European Court of Justice, the Papillon case, which said that when you consolidate group, when you have a consolidated tax group, which means that you have a chain of companies, they can be consolidated. So income and profit are determined based on the group as a whole. And you could still have, for example, French consolidation, even though you have a UK parent or you have UK companies in a chain of French companies. But that is only true because there's freedom of establishment and the French government cannot discriminate a UK company from a French company. Well, going forward, if the UK is no longer part of the EU, that should also fall away. So what happens to an existing French structure, for example, that has a UK company in the middle of the tax consolidated group? You would no longer be able to consolidate. What happens with the structure? Do you need to reorganize? And there are going to be a lot of those examples going forward as people start reviewing the implication of Brexit and the potential tax leakage that might create and really trap for the unwary.
I just wanted to add that there's, at least from a French point of view, there's a lot of tax measures that are extended to EU companies, and in fact, they're also extended to EU and EEA companies. So, and typically what Cécile mentioned about the tax consolidation, these advantages are granted to EU and EEA companies. So if the UK stays in the EEA, then probably there won't be too many issues.
And the question is going to be, what kind of relationship will the UK have going forward? Will it be like the EEA or something else, or something completely bespoke? So as we mentioned, but going forward, what you do now, we know there might be an exit, and so what do we do? Well, maybe one thing is, like, going forward in agreements, maybe it was thinking putting maybe MAC or changing law clauses to try to give you some protection going forward and some flexibility. And also kind of monitor the changes that might also happen within the EU. I mean, we've seen the French government a little bit cheekily talking about rolling the red carpet to UK companies that are based in the UK and see what, you know, what kind of great tax deal they might get in France. And they have announced that they are actually thinking about changing their own tax regime to try to make it more attractive. For example, in France, they have announced that they might change the tax regime applicable to expatriates to give them a better deal than what they currently have, with the hope of obviously taking some business from the city. But Spain also has announced last week, I think, the government, that they might be willing to consider tax breaks for banks. So it's not just actually UK legislation and UK taxes that we will need to monitor going forward. It's actually potential changes within the EU. And that's actually going to be a challenging and interesting time, I think, coming up for all of us in the area of tax. And obviously, there was this project at the EU, maybe as a last word, the Common Consolidated Corporate Tax Base and the Financial Transaction Tax. And the UK was actually quite a vocal opponent to, for example, the Financial Transaction Tax. And the question is that's going to get momentum now that maybe we'll see if the UK is out of the EU. So watch this space.
Great. Well, we've run over a little bit. I mean, we're happy to stay and address any questions anyone has. But for folks who need to leave, please feel free to do so now. We did have one question that came in, which basically says, as the UK will no longer be considered part of the EU, is it expected that bilateral agreements will have to be negotiated with each of the UK's EU counterparties to allow exchange of information under CRS? And I think the short answer to that is that I think the CRS is implemented itself by a multilateral competent authority agreement. So I think there already is sort of a separate agreement that member states have signed on to that implements that, and presumably that would not be affected by the Brexit. Let's just see if anyone else have any questions or comments. Please feel free. That's great. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And watch this space.
Thank you.